Welcome to the Virtual Philanthropy Donor Podcast Series. Today's people in philanthropy are Nagar Tayar with Global Wellbeing Fund and Josie Norton with Choose Love. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
We're on a bit of a multinational call today. I believe, Nagar, you're in San Francisco, and Josie, you're in London, I believe?
Yes, I'm in London indeed.
So, since you just spoke, can I have you sort of talk more about your organization, Choose Love?
Absolutely. So we are an organization that was founded in 2015 to support refugees and displaced people and those affected by conflict, persecution and climate change. And we support those communities by fundraising and then identifying the most effective community-based organizations, very often led by the impact of the communities themselves, and grant giving to them in a fast and flexible way. And we work all over the world in 26 countries, supporting about 200 different organizations.
Now, you're working in 26 countries all over the world, talking about community-based organizations. How on earth are you doing that in a way that seems like it's effective while choosing love and not frustration?
It's a very good question. The organization sprang into being because of a crisis that was happening in 2015. And
you're not talking about Brexit, are you?
Well, they're very interconnected, actually. We were just ordinary people wanting to do something to help. And so it happened very organically that we wanted to understand the situation on the ground better ourselves. And so went to France, went to Greece. And when we got there, we kind of expected to see large institutions, governments, NGOs responding. And what we saw was that grassroots organizations were the ones who were actually responding on the front lines. And so we very naturally wanted to help those who were helping. And that's how our model got born. And we've tried to stay really true to our values and making sure that we really know what is happening in the context that we're working and who is doing the work.
And Nagar, can you tell us about the Global Wellbeing Fund? Bit of a mouthful there.
I have very mixed feelings about our name. Given that it's very long, but it kind of like, it says every word really means something, as someone was saying the other day. So EJ, what I do is basically I reimagine how we welcome and support people who are forced to flee their homes. Because me and my family had to flee our homes and leave everything behind in the late 80s post-revolution in Iran. And we had a very difficult journey and ended up in Germany. And you're probably hearing the funny German accent.
I don't think it's funny at all.
You're one of the few that would say that, I think. But yeah, the organization that I co-founded and had the privilege to lead since 7 years really focuses on reimagining how to advance the rights and the well-being of communities that are displaced. Through funding, but also through organizational development. So we really reimagine effective, holistic, dignified ways of serving people and helping people not just to survive, but also to thrive. And we do that in very, very close partnership with Choose Love. Choose Love, in fact, has taught us a lot, shaped our work a lot, and it's been a privilege to work together.
You're already doing the shameless plug. Look at you. I didn't even have to bring us to that section. It's already happening. I love it. Well, as a former donor focused on children on the move, I have a really strong affinity for the work that you're doing. But for our audience, could you just define exactly what people on the move means? It doesn't just mean refugee or migrant, does it?
No. So I know the word is not perfect, but we are not aiming for perfection. So given that, I mean, take my own journey, right? My family, when I was born, we were internally displaced. My parents had already fled their positions, they were escaping, they were on the run, fleeing for their life. So from being internally displaced, I then became a person who was seeking refugee protection with the United Nations office in Turkey, which we were denied of. Then we became undocumented in Turkey because we didn't have the paper or the legal authorization to be in Turkey. Then we became asylum seekers that were entering Germany through the asylum pathway, seeking protection and finally being granted asylum status and then becoming a citizen. And then now I am a migrant who lives in the US since 7 years. And given all these things, like I embody all the different legal categories that exist on mobility, most of them, we knew very quickly that people can't really make sense of what these categories mean. And most people, including myself, felt like I don't want to be reduced to just a refugee. I'm a person. I want to be seen as a full woman, a full person, and not be reduced to a stigmatized category. And, you know, refugee used to be a badge of honor, but right now it's very stigmatized and very complicated and politicized. That's why we landed on people on the move. People who are moving, most of them are moving because they have to, because home is not safe for climate or conflict-related reasons.
I couldn't agree with Nika more on that. But I was just going to add that Choose Love was originally called Help Refugees when we first began, and that was simply because we were seeing this crisis that was happening in Europe and wanted to do something to help, hence the word help, and wanted to describe who it was that we were helping. And so the name Help Refugees was born. And then through doing this work, we understand that the word help is in and of itself quite problematic. And as Nagar said, we understood that reducing people to the term refugee was not dignified, and in fact placed labels on people when some people weren't being given the status of being a refugee and they were still an asylum seeker or they were undocumented. And so after kind of going on this journey of understanding all of that, we changed our name to Choose Love, which we felt was a much more appropriate name for the work that we do and represented what we wanted to see in the world.
There's been quite the move in philanthropy to find a function for philanthropy that relies less on the response and more on prevention. But in areas of crises and conflicts and doing this kind of funding prevention doesn't seem feasible. We can't fund to prevent earthquakes or sadly wars, but are there things that philanthropy can do in terms of just preventative measures or something in place that we can do that we're not looking at, that we're just not seeing, that you might be able to indicate?
I'd love to speak to that, actually. And I think what we can do is resource community-based organizations, resource the organizations who are led by the impacted communities, invest in them, not with super restricted budget lines. These organizations know what they need to grow. They know what they need to make themselves sustainable. And when you resource these organizations and you resource ecosystems, they are not only able to create change for themselves, but they're also made resilient for when things like an earthquake happens. And an example of that is our partners, the White Helmets, who have spent the last, you know, decade responding to shelling, becoming a search and rescue organization, being the organization that is the fire service, is often the ambulance service, and they have used grants to invest in vehicles, in search and rescue equipment, in early warning systems. One of the things that Choose Love has funded for them is communications equipment. And so when this earthquake struck, they were the only organization that was able to do a search and rescue effort. And the communication devices that Choose Love had purchased for them were what was used to communicate between teams when the internet went down, when the earthquake happened. And so I think that model of local to global is something that people talk about a lot, but it doesn't necessarily happen. But I think, as you say, to maybe not prevent things from happening, but prevent them from being as bad or having such a drastic human impact, then resourcing these organizations to make them best prepared is something that we can do.
Do you think that's something that needs to be promoted more? That we should be telling people more about some of these measures, because I think sometimes it gets lost. We just think, oh, how can we keep funding these things over and over again? Yet we don't see any progress. But these are examples of progress. So are we not talking about them more? Is it more that it's better to keep that under wraps?
I think it's interesting, right? Because progress really depends on how we define it. If our ambition is to solve issues and prevent issues from happening, we are always going to be frustrated because, to your point, we are more, it's this weird thing, right, where we are more powerful than we think. Oftentimes we deny our own power as people, but we are not as powerful as preventing earthquakes or natural catastrophes to happen or conflict, right? So I think it really depends on how we define progress. And I think that is really at the core of also what Josie was saying, moving away from traditional ways of engaging that are mostly transactional in nature, and moving towards investing in people, investing in models, investing in communities. Because Josie and I, we both have different hats. I also am honored to be the chair of the Choose Love Board here in the U.S. So we have done a lot of work over the last 7 years together. And quite frankly, of the 200 organizations we have supported, all of them have progressed in one way or another. It's just a matter of what do we define to be progress as. And I think if we were to be able to move away from a transaction that is supposed to, let's say, solve healthcare for Northwest Syria, which includes 4.5 million people. Oh, and by the way, there is no government that is doing anything, and the international community is really very absent, right? That's not possible. But then you see an organization like International Doctors Association, IDA, led and run by Syrian doctors who are all impacted themselves. Most of them have lost their homes right now due to the earthquake, and many, many members of their families. And yet they're providing healthcare for 1.5 million people for free. People in Northwest Syria, thanks to IDA, have better healthcare than some people here in the U.S. And that is because these brave and bold actors stepped up and are moving their resources and their skills towards that and aligning it. I think one way to change things is to really redefine what does progress mean, and to really engage in a meaningful dialogue and relationship with the organizations that we are resourcing, as opposed to transactions.
How could philanthropy combat the news cycle effect that pulls the urgent needs of vulnerable communities away from the public eye, even as situations seem to be worsening?
So Choose Love raises half of its funding from the public. And I think something that is quite unique about the way that we communicate is that we don't focus solely on emergency narratives, of depressing narratives, of a narrative that others, the communities who are in need of support. And I think whilst it is really important that in the moments like an earthquake or the invasion, the illegal invasion of Ukraine, we tell the truth and we talk about the urgent needs and the human suffering that's taking place, that we don't only focus on that. And so we also highlight the incredible success stories of organizations. We talk about the amazing individuals who have overcome so much and are doing incredible things. But more than that, while storytelling is really important to engage people on a topic and on an issue and get them involved and wanting to find out what happened after the news stopped talking about it in headlines, who is telling stories is probably more important. And so we really try and use our platform to be a place that our partner organizations can use to tell their stories. It's there to serve a purpose of amplification. And we like to really make sure that we're constantly learning as well about what stories that we should be telling, that we work with incredible leaders in the space. Our creative director is an amazing BAFTA-winning filmmaker called Hassan Akkad, who himself made his own journey from Syria to the UK and filmed it on a GoPro. And that ended up becoming a documentary called Exodus, which won a BAFTA. And I think the kind of the nuances in watching that film and the subsequent films that he's made, and indeed the content that he shares, people's hearts and minds are moved in a different way, which is really important.
Nicole, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is, you know, it could get tiring to think on only about what you are funding, right? If what you're funding is just diapers, right, or as they say in the UK, which Josie taught me, nappies.
Yes, nappies.
if your focus is on funding diapers and nappies or school bags, of course, at some point you're asking yourself, this feels like a black bottomless hole. But if your focus is not only on the what, but on the how the work is being done, the individuals you're investing into that are doing the work, who are ever growing and learning and adjusting. Because what happens, what we see in moments of crisis, I mean, imagine we were at the Turkish-Syrian border 4 weeks after the earthquake hit. We met individuals who had not only lost their homes, but they also lost their families. One of them was sharing with us that he had just been celebrating the birthday of his mother, and the six people he celebrated with are all dead now, and he was there when they were passing and when they were buried under the building. And yet he was, as his colleague, doing remarkable work in finding temporary housing for people, providing access to doctors, providing access to food, blankets. So I think it's also important to look at the how, meaning how individuals are progressing and doing the work, how they are holding the work. And in our view, I think, speaking for Josie and myself, because we've talked about this a lot, that has so many ripple effects, right? Because it introduces a whole new way of being and doing this work under very, very harsh circumstances.
Nagar, I know you can speak to this as well, that for the most part, I would say philanthropy is really about connecting with other donors and other partners, really behind the scenes. You either emailing, you're contacting other donors saying, do you know who's working on this, who's focusing on this? And you try to make those connections happen behind the scenes. Now, your organization is probably the exact opposite. You're really putting on blast what you're doing. You're out there reaching out to donors in a very explicit way. What are some of the sort of pros and cons with that approach?
I think the huge pro in this approach is, in my view, really the future is collective. Right? We are going through a huge paradigm shift in which I think COVID was also quite pivotal to realize how much we are connected and how one thing, one virus over there can spread and, like, you know, determine so many people's trajectories and for such a long time. Right? So in my view, the future is really collective. It requires to share resources. And it requires to take a very complementary approach and realize my comparative advantage is that I'm based in California and that people who have an amount of wealth or access to power listen to me, given my situatedness and my experience and where I am. The comparative advantage of our colleague in Northwest Syria is that they actually have a finger on the pulse. They are living the realities that we are talking about, and they're constantly, creatively, effectively finding ways to pivot. A flood is happening. Okay, we got to pivot. A snowstorm is happening. We got to pivot. So I think the pro of such an approach is really, especially for philanthropies who have access to so much power, and I'm not just talking about the revenue that they have at their disposal, the money that they can move out, but also their situatedness, their access to decision makers, their access to other powerful people with resources. I think now, given where we are with climate, with displacement, we have to pull on the same string. It's not a choice. It's a necessity, and it's a smart thing to do. I would think the downside in that, I really don't see any downside in it, because at the end of the day, I was just trying to say, shall I just come up with something just to answer that question? But I think I push back. I push back and say, if my mission is, as an example, advancing the rights of girls, right, then why would I not want to join forces and partner with other organizations that are advancing the rights of girls? Is that going to harm me? If not, we see so much of what is happening, and the global movement that Choose Love started is based on that very simple premise of sharing, joining forces, and organizing, mobilizing together, and the effects are just magical. So I think it's not only from an idealistic view, that's how the world should operate, but also from a very sober, like practical view, that just makes sense.
I couldn't agree more. I was just thinking then, as Nega was talking about, you know, the kind of, there's a phrase, divide and conquer, that that is used for a reason. And when people who are doing good work are working in a scarcity mindset or working in competitive nature with each other, then they lose power. and we really are stronger together. And when we unite with all of our different superpowers, then change can really, really happen. And just as a little anecdotal story, we say split and sparkle instead of divide and conquer. And that's our, you know, we all have different talents and we can all do different things, but we don't have to be divided to do that. We can do that together as one and sparkle while we're doing it.
I love that. We're getting into the section of the shameless plug, which I feel like you've already been doing. And I'm almost scared to do shameless plug. I feel like you could be here for 5 hours just plugging everyone that you love, giving all the organizations that you support. But I guess sort of reimagining this idea of the shameless plug, what are some of the things that your organizations that you love? And you obviously feel free to plug organizations specifically. I mean, you've got Choose Love here specifically for that as well. But beyond that, what are some of the things that you see on the ground that just make you proud to be doing the work that you're doing?
Well, Nagar and I just got back from Turkey and the border of Syria, visiting our partners there. One of our colleagues actually crossed over the border into northwest Syria. And the ecosystem of organizations that work there are just, they really are the best possible example of what a bottom-up approach can achieve, and what people who are so deeply rooted in values of justice and humanity and compassion and impartiality can do. And I think something that we've said a lot over the last few weeks is, even if our response to the earthquake that we did together, our two organizations, if that's all we've done in our careers or indeed lives, then we would know that we'd led a good life. Was it Nagar said that, and it's really, really stuck with me. And these organizations, the White Helmets, who we were just talking about, they are a team of 3,000 volunteers with a team of 200 people supporting them to do their work. They're supporting 4.5 million people. In the earthquake alone, they physically rescued 3,000 people from the rubble. They've saved over 100,000 people from rubble over the last decade. I mean, if that isn't something to be proud to be a tiny bit involved in, then I don't know what is.
Nagar?
I was just fighting with my tears, and it's not tears of sadness, but really, like, because I cannot tell you. Josie knows the Northwest Syrian context for many years and has been there for many, many years. She has been going back and forth for about 7 years to the Turkish side of the border, at least. For me, it was the first time I visited, and I had read about it, heard about it. I had some concerns about it because of all the misinformation and disinformation that is happening on purpose, intentionally by online. So I think if there's one thing to really uplift is the fact that you have incredible people in that context who are using the skills that they have crafted, like a surgeon who has been, you know, trained to be a surgeon for many years, not thinking that this is where he would end up and this is what he would do. And now he is working 5 days a week in a nonprofit that is providing free access to healthcare for very vulnerable people, from chemo patients to children to delivering babies. And then on the weekends really crosses into a very complex situation into Northwest Syria and is giving surgery 2 days in a row. So I think my shameless plug here really is to back the Syrian-led organizations in these very, very important and difficult contexts, because what they are doing is not just important for that context and for those people. I don't care. If you don't care about the Syrian community, that's fine. You don't have to. But it's investing in a whole new way of doing things as people. And I think when you see that, you can't leave without feeling that, wow, this is what it looks like when people really own the power and the agency that they have and stand up for the convictions that they share. And that's a life well spent, I think. So that would be my shameless plug. Support us. The earthquake campaign is still going on. You may not read about it in the news, but the realities are that people still need help. This phase of resiliency is really important, and it takes resources. We are committed to do whatever it takes, and we can't do it alone. So I would just shamelessly plug again and say, please support our work, because we are not here just for today. We are going to be here next year as well. We are committed to back these communities and their demand for self-determination and freedom.
Well, it's a good segue into the virtual tour. Normally the virtual tour during this, I ask donors to sort of walk us through how nonprofits can find them, basically contact them. But I think in your case, it's pretty easy to be able to contact you, especially you, Nagar, in terms of how to work with you. So just sort of, so we talk about reimagining things. Given that so much of your work is about trying to bring other high-level donors together, I'd like this to be a tour about your due diligence in finding the right partners on both sides, both the donor side and the nonprofit side, and how you sort of chart the best course forward towards an action of navigating these crisis zones.
Absolutely. I think people always, we just had a call with a donor last week and they were saying, how do you source local actors on the ground? I'm like, we don't have a sourcing issue. We have a resourcing issue because we have so many organizations that are connected, that are basically recommended by our existing partners. Like take the White Hammers as an example. They really asked us to look into child protection and recommended an organization that we ended up resourcing. We wouldn't have found that organization. Their website is pretty lousy. It doesn't show up in any Google search, right? And neither is any of the prominent donors supporting them. So I think in terms of the nonprofits, we rely heavily on peer-to-peer support by existing partners that we are resourcing and word of mouth, and we are open to receive emails. We receive emails on an ongoing basis, and I'm very proud to say that every email is answered. We may not be able to support everybody, given that we have to stick to our mission, and there is only a finite amount of resources. But nonprofits are always welcome to reach out and endorse others. In fact, we give you like a 5-star thing in our assessment if you are saying, you know what, don't just look at my work. There are these other two organizations. The one is doing LGBTQ plus sheltering. The other one is looking at women violence prevention work. So that's how nonprofits can reach us. And in terms of the donor community, we are very aware that we only know what we know. And everybody has blind spots. So with other donors, we heavily rely on their diligence, and we always share our diligence, and so does Choose Love. We are very transparent. Whatever we can, based on legal issues and confidentiality, we always are willing to share. And to give you an example, we are now investing in effective organizational support, basically meaning tidying up an organization from the inside, like doing spring cleaning, looking at their boards, helping them with fundraising, helping them to figure out very complex HR systems, which when you have a global team, it can get quite complicated. So we decided we are not going to provide that for our own existing partners. We are going to ask the global community, our peers, and say, who would you like to endorse and why are you endorsing them? Who should we look into? And we got about 150 recommendations, which we have been sorting through. Now the challenge is to reduce it down to 12. All of them are led by refugees from Asia Pacific all the way to Venezuela, Colombia. So if other donors are interested in supporting that work, please do, because we have a waiting list that is long and exceeds the resources that we have. So that's it. I mean, and bottom lining, nonprofits can always reach out, and we are very frank about what we can support and what we can't. And in some instances, we help them connect to other donors. And donors always are welcome to reach out because we are very transparent in our practice and are happy to share. And in fact, we are looking into co-investment opportunities, knowing that we can't do what we do alone.
Josie, for you, obviously, you're working with really sort of grassroots community-based organizations who may not have, they've heard of Choosing Love, but that might just be within their home. They choose love in their home, but not necessarily choosing love on a Google search. How would they find you? How would they be able to reach out to you and see the work that you're doing in a way that can sort of connect to what they're doing?
To be honest, quite often it's the other way around. And in one of the kind of core strands of our work is this emergency response, this crisis response. And in that moment, we know that it's the grassroots community-based organizations who are going to be responding, and they're going to be caught up in this this moment of crisis and doing everything that they can to get their teams together, to get volunteers, to find their way through the obstacles, to get the aid and support to those who need it. And we know that although the kind of global community will be committing funds, those funds won't be reaching those organizations. So we actually very proactively, through the networks that Nego was just describing, through networks of organizations, through networks of people who have worked in the sector and on the ground for a long time, of journalists, of activists that we know from those regions, we will be asking who are the organizations who are responding. We know that marginalized communities are going to be often left behind in people's strategies. So we will be trying to identify who is the organization that's supporting people with disabilities, who's supporting the elderly, who's supporting the LGBTQ community. So something that happened both with Ukraine and with the earthquake is people said, wow, before we'd even had time to think about where we were going to get the funding from, your team had reached out. Something I would say to organizations is, even if people don't have a call for an open call on their website, it's still always worth sending an email. Even if the organization get back to you and say that they don't have available funding in that moment, they might think of you later. That does happen to us. We do sometimes do open calls as well, and we will often take recommendations from partner organizations. So there's no one rule. It really varies on where our funding's coming from and what crisis we're responding to.
How do you find a narrowing down process? I guess that's for both of you. As you talked about going from 150 to 12, I know a lot about that with my time in philanthropy as well. It's not something that's very easy to do. So just sort of give a notice, as you said, I think that was great that you gave that sort of note of encouragement to the nonprofits listening, Josie, but just sort of speak more broadly to the process or what it means. You know, sometimes it's hard to fathom when you need money coming in that you have a competition level of 150 other organizations, sometimes 1,050, sometimes even more than that, depending on who you're asking for funding. So just talk about that process of sort of whittling down and what it really means for those organizations in terms of their worth, whether or not they get your funding.
I mean, to be honest, I think that's one of the hardest things about this work. And, you know, it feels so wrong to place value on one organization's work over another organization's work. And even more wrong to think to be implying in any way that one life is worth more than another, because it absolutely isn't. And I think that it is one of the most uncomfortable things about this sector. And because there is a scarcity of resources, these kind of decisions do have to be made. But nonetheless, we do have to have a process for these kind of things. And so we work to have a set of criteria that looks at an organization's values. It looks at their absorption capacity. It looks at, you know, there are organizations who don't necessarily need our funding. We try and prioritize the community-based organizations who are local, who can really can use our funding. We want to make sure that we're supporting them to use it in the best way possible. We prioritize organizations who are led by people with lived experience. After that, we prioritize organizations who are led by those in the host community. And we're looking at where does an emergency start, where does an emergency end, and then who are the really innovative organizations who are doing something that's never been done before and who are developing their strategy and integrating their learnings as they go. But it's a hard process, it would be like to say otherwise. I'll pass over to Nega.
Yeah, I think in our case, see, the way that Choose Love has built a very sophisticated and holistic model is you take people's whole need into account. Yes. The fact that they need to have a warm and dry and hopefully safe shelter, all the way to warm food, to legal support, mental health care, and those pieces, access to education. The way that we are working now with the Global Well-Being Fund is to really look into which organizations like Choose Love are the boats that are the tides that lift all these boats, right? And how can we support them in the best way possible? So when we are engaging between this organization or that organization, we are taking all kinds of things into consideration, including the question of, are these team players? Are these organizations that are just interested in advancing their own organizational agenda, which, don't get me wrong, is okay to do that. Everybody has their mission and is committed to achieving their mission, but we are looking for something more than that. We are looking for organizations that are willing to team up and proactively work with others, like the White Helmet example that I was sharing. They didn't have to point towards child protection done by another organization. They did that because they see themselves as responsible for ensuring that the communities they are serving had all the services that they need beyond what they just are able to offer themselves. So I think in our case, this element of like ecosystem relevance and are these team players, and also, frankly, are they good in leveraging existing resources? Because even though the issue that we work on is so important, it's like, I would think, one of the most global pressing issues, and it affects so many other pieces, as we have seen through elections and Brexit, which we were talking about earlier, it's not really well funded. So we also have to look for organizations that are really effective in what they do, but are also cost efficient and are able to raise more support than what we are offering. Because we all, I think, are dreaming of a world in which people who have lost everything get all the support they need in order to rebuild and thrive in the new environments in which they are, and that requires money.
Another shameless plug, just to add to that.
This is the shameless podcast, no worries.
But again, to mention the White Helmets, who we were just in their administrative office in Montreal, where you are, EJ. But when we were in that office, they showed us this video about how integral vehicles are to their response. And, you know, it was the vehicles that were assisting in the search and rescue of people from the rubble that respond to the fires. And then they were showing us their system of how they track their vehicles. And at any one time, you can go into this dashboard and you can see all of the vehicles, where they are, what they're doing, who is driving them. But also you can see when it was last filled up with fuel, and you could see how much fuel it's using to its mileage, so that they can be assessing to make sure that it's still worth keeping that vehicle in use, with how much fuel it's using and when it becomes more cost efficient to get another vehicle. I mean, the sophistication in that is just incredible. They really are making sure that every single cent goes to helping people in the best way possible. And I mean, why would you not want to work with an organization who is being that innovative and smart?
I'm scared that some donors might hear that and say, oh, we should have all of our nonprofits doing that, which I don't know if I necessarily want that happening across the board, but yeah, no, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, they're setting the bar quite high, huh?
Yeah.
Thinking about do's and don'ts now, well, I feel like the theme of this has been both shameless plugs and reimagining. So here's another section that I'm reimagining. You know, there are a lot of expectations and assumptions about funding and working in a crisis and disaster zone or area. What are some of the do's and don'ts that you would have for both nonprofits to know before contacting you, but also for donors in this space or wanting to get into this space about what they should be talking about, especially when you talk about metrics? What are some of those do's and don'ts? I mean, it's great that White Helmets does that, but I'm worried about setting that kind of expectation on other nonprofits that may not have that capability.
I think, you know, restricted funding is something that, while in some occasions is necessary, it should not be the norm, and it is not what helps organizations to thrive, and it's not what helps organizations to support their communities as best that they can. We have to have a trust-based relationship with organizations. We have to believe that they are the experts about what they are doing. And as someone who wears both hats as both a donor and an organization that receives funds, you know, spending so much time on proposals and reports that often aren't, they're all in different formats and they're asking for completely different things, and trying to rearrange budget lines constantly because different people want to restrict things for different things, and then the needs of your partners are also changing. You're not able to have the space that you need, and our partners are not able to have the space that they need to strategize and evaluate what they're doing and incorporate those learnings and do that big sky thinking that's really important. So I think whilst accountability and transparency, as we talked about earlier, are really important, there are different ways to having unmovable budget lines and extremely restricted grants. That would be my big takeaway, I think.
When you discuss talking about restricted funding, because obviously this is something that comes up quite often in philanthropy, do you think it would be better if donors themselves who are sort of imposing restrictions, had somebody, whether it's somebody within the organization or someone within the board that might be setting those restrictions, come and talk to nonprofits about why they're doing that? Or do you think it might be better to have sort of grassroots organizations coming in, helping inform how those restrictions should be formed?
I think, the thing is that we also have to, I hear where your question is coming from, and I love the problem solving aspect of it. But I also think it's important to say that some foundations and some philanthropies cannot change the way they are doing their processes for many, many reasons. And it's okay. But I think it's realizing that you may not be the fastest in responding, but to then join other organizations that are. Like, to give you an example, many of the, for the Ukraine response, we probably have raised under the Choose Love campaign, $60 million from 38,000 people altogether. Some of these people are people, like you and me. Others are entities, philanthropic entities. And you would be surprised without, you know, breaking confidentiality. Some of them have such a thick red tape in their bureaucratic institutions that they weren't able to do the granting themselves, but they were able to grant to us, given the credibility and the longstanding experience and the fact that we can deal with high bureaucratic processes. We can give you 50 pages long proposals. We have a very sophisticated monitoring and evaluation system that can tell you X meals have been served here in that region. So we are equipped to do that. So I think I would, rather than having like a blueprint approach and saying this is the fix to all the problems, I would just say maybe it's about respecting that everybody has certain parameters within they have to work, but then not stopping there and saying, oh God, we can't do anything, but do what many of our philanthropic peers do. We have received so many notes from people that said, I've actually managed to plug that into my board. They won't fund this organization directly, but they're happy to do that through you. So I think, and that also comes back to this idea of a collective action. A collective action basically means everybody's point of departure is their comparative strength, right? And you know what you know, and you know what you don't know, what you can do, what you can't do, and you join forces on the pieces where you can't, but you know it's important to do. I'd slightly push back and just say that. I'm curious if Josie wants to add to it.
No, I just want to, say how much I'm smiling if people could see me, because that collective response is where our power lies. And it's something that, working with the Global Wellbeing Fund, we as an organization have learned, but I also have learned on a personal level, how much stronger we are when we work together, and how okay it is that we're all good at different things, and how actually we are more effective when we work out what all of our lanes are, and then we come together and be a giant freeway together. And that is something that people need to learn. And again, moving away from kind of being competitive to being each other's champions, I think is where the future lies.
Well, this is the first I've ever heard about red tape in philanthropy. I'll have to look that up on the internet after we're done here.
Uh-oh.
I've already asked you, or rather you've already volunteered so much about your experiences, but I just invite you once more to just offer maybe an experience that you'd like to share, whether it's about engaging with a donor on some of the work you're doing, or engaging with a nonprofit. Just any experience that you would like to share that you think it would be worthy for the nonprofits and the donors listening to hear.
I don't know if this is the right answer to the question.
There's no wrong answer, so you're fine.
Okay, but I think we're an organization or organizations that work really at scale now. We work in so many different contexts. Millions of people have been touched by our work and the work of the movement. But it's important to ground yourself in the individual stories. And when I first started doing this in Northern France, we worked with a lot of unaccompanied children as young as 8 years old. And we're now nearly 8 years on. And over the last year or so, I've started to get sent quite often photos of those kids now graduating school, applying to college, going, like, being the star of a sports team. Not that success is judged by those things, just the fact that they're well and happy is actually all that matters. But seeing things like that and being reminded that although it can feel overwhelming that the world
has seemingly got more unstable, that there are more forcibly displaced people, actually humans all coming together and making this work possible actually really does change lives, and that's what it's all about. That's why we get up in the morning.
And I was just thinking about this example where Putin had just invaded Ukraine and our worlds were turned upside down, not to the extent that, you know, we weren't directly impacted, but we were very severely impacted. We were basically living and breathing those realities day in, day out. And for a majority of the first 3 months, right, Josie, we were just living and breathing that same air.
Yeah.
And I remember we were hitting, you know how it is with emergency responses, you go through the ups and downs. The up is when you are able to say, oh, here, hand in hand for aid and development, we have 750,000 that we can give you to upgrade an entire community and give them access to proper housing and allow people who haven't had a shower in 4 weeks to finally wash themselves, right? Downside being, oh my God, we have been doing this nonstop because we believe it's important and lives are at stake. And then there is the Northwest Syrian situation. Then there are people who are trapped in, closed camps on the Aegean Islands. People who are literally kidnapped at the U.S.-Mexico border, not far from where I am. And we were just feeling sad and also quite, to be frank, quite desperate. How are we going to do this? How are we going to also, ethically, how can we serve this community while also making sure other communities are getting the resources they need? And I'll never forget, we received this email by a funder that is based in Boston. I don't know if they want their name to be disclosed, but I'd rather be on the safe side and don't disclose their name. But they reached out and said, you know what, we are going to give $300,000 for the Ukraine response, but you don't have to use it for Ukraine. We know everybody is now paying attention to Ukraine, and that is important, but we entrust you with our funds to do whatever you think is most needed. And I think Josie and I, we were just speechless, right? We were just thinking, oh my God, this is so, what a privilege and what a burden. What are we going to do? But it was so humbling, you know, to see that over the course of us doing this work, to your point, and like, well, how do you do donor engagement? We are basically always transparent, sharing what we do, why we make certain decisions, what is difficult, where the needs are based on what people say. We never say we know. We always say XYZ has told us, right? But I think for that experience to happen, it just showed us that doing all this work matters. You know, building relationships matters, and sometimes you see the fruits of that seed of trust that you planted like 5 years ago, exactly 5 years later, right? Yeah. So that would be the story that comes to me, EJ.
That's a long-term relationship if I've ever heard one. That's great.
We are all about long-term relationships, yes.
We've now reached the end where we talk about the future. And normally I ask our guests to answer one question about the future. But since I've got two of you here, I figured I'd ask you a question each. So going in no particular order, I'll start with you, Nigar. What is something you would like to see change in the future of emergency response from the philanthropic community?
That's actually quite easy. I live and breathe for that piece. I want to, firstly, emergencies are inevitable. I am not wishing an emergency to happen, but we know an emergency is going to kick in one way or another very soon again. I would love to see that 3 months into that emergency, when we crunch the numbers, we actually see 25% of the funding went to proximate organizations that were there yesterday, organizations that are there to stay after the news has disappeared from the headlines. Quite frankly, going beyond the 0.4%, which is still today's reality, to 25%, I think that would be a game changer. That would be my dream. Josie, what about yours?
I mean, we work together on this, so I mean, my answer is the same. I would like to see people being really, really thoughtful about where they're giving to, and it not being sometimes a knee-jerk reaction to just give to somewhere where they've heard of before, and to take the time to find out who are these organizations, and also to not always wait for emergencies. I know the question was about what to do in an emergency, but maybe we don't need to always wait for the emergency, and we can resource these organizations before the emergency happens, so that they are better prepared to respond.
See, this is why I decided to ask you both individual questions. I figure the answers might be so similar considering how much you guys work together. So for you, Daisy, I'd ask you, what areas of innovation should donors invest in now that would improve emergency responses and humanitarian efforts in the future? You've just touched upon it a bit right there in your answer, but just going maybe a bit deeper.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I really, really do believe that we have to invest in not just organizations, but ecosystems. One organization can't carry a response by itself, even an organization as amazing as the White Helmets. You need different organizations of different sizes who respond in different ways. You know, diversity is important in all aspects of life, and that includes in the ecosystems in which we work. So I think people having strategies to find these organizations and ecosystems. If I had to be thinking in geographies, I'd love to see more funding go to the Middle East. We've worked there for a long time and seen the needs increase and the funding decrease, and that's absolutely heartbreaking to witness. Yeah, that's my answer.
Yeah, I would add, I mean, Josie knows, I'm an organizational development geek. Yeah. I also work as an executive coach on the side, and I would just love to see more. It's crazy, right, to say that it's innovative and radical to invest in organizations itself, not just in the work that they do. Kind of feels a little bit like common sense, but unfortunately, that's not where the money is flowing to. So I think giving organizations space to grow, stabilize, to flourish, to scale, but them setting the terms for what that looks like and matching them with talented coaches and consultants all over the world, not just from the global north, but also from the global south. For me, that would be innovative and would transform the impact that we see on so many levels.
So many things that actually, when you say them, seem so obvious, are actually so radical in this space. And things like investing in organizations or resourcing those who are actually on the front line or have been impacted themselves. One would think that would be obvious and be common sense, like Nika said, but it is radical. And I think we're here to do our part to try and change that.
I think we have to stop calling common sense common sense. I don't think it's that common anymore. Something has happened. Or it's just become much more uncommon.
That's true.
We need to call it uncommon sense. I'm not sure.
Uncommon sense. I'm going to start using that, EJ.
There you are. You can take it. I won't. There's no proof that I've given it to you. So there you are. And with that, we're done. Thank you so much, Nagata Yar from Global Wellbeing Fund and Josie Norton from Choose Love. Thank you for choosing to be here with me today.
Thank you so much
for having us, EJ.
My pleasure, and thank you for listening.